Good afternoon. Welcome to Division 6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have just one case scheduled on our 1:30 docket, Creekside Hotel Associates versus General Innkeeping Acceptance Corporation. I see counsel at council table. I assume you're both ready to proceed. You should have each received a set of written instructions detailing our oral argument procedures. Let me just ask now if any counsel have any questions about those procedures? Okay. I'd remind counsel, please, when you come to the podium, identify yourself by name and attorney registration number. And I'd ask if anybody has a pager or cell phone, please turn it off now so that it won't interrupt other counsel in the court during oral argument. And unless there are any questions, we are ready for oral argument.
May it please the court. My name is Darrell Campbell, registration 8221, appearing on behalf of the appellant in this case, Creekside Hotel Associates, LLC. The matter comes before the court today for review concerning the Arapahoe County District Court's order granting the appellees General Innkeeping Acceptance Corporations, and I'll refer to it as GIAC. Motion to dismiss a complaint that was filed by Creekside in 2007. The trial court, in entering its order, determined that the claims asserted by Creekside in the 2007 case were mandatory counterclaims, which should have been asserted in a 2006 action, which had previously been filed between these same parties by GIAC. The court determined that these were compulsory counterclaims and that as a result, they should be dismissed. The 2006 case, which was the basis for the district court's decision, was an action filed by GIAC in connection with a foreclosure. It was a foreclosure that had gone through the Rule 120, been authorized, the sale had gone through. Creekside had filed for bankruptcy in an attempt to obtain additional time for financing. The bankruptcy had been dismissed. The order included a determination that it was not extended. The time for redemption had not been extended. And based upon that, GIAC filed a claim in 2006 with the Arapahoe County District Court. The action in that case sought an order of court determining that they were entitled as a matter of law to the public trustee giving them a deed to the property as a result of the sale, and they were the high bidder. And a further order determining that Creekside had no redemptive rights in the property anymore. That was the 2006 action. The 2007 action dealt with matters involving post-default conduct, misconduct, which was in essence a breach of good faith and fair dealing. It involved matters which occurred after the note, which is the basis for this particular action, and the foreclosure had matured. Actions which the complaint alleged was in breach of the good faith and fair dealing. In essence, the lender had, through its actions and in discretionary enforcement of its rights of creditor rights, including the foreclosure and refusing payment, had thwarted the borrower's efforts to pay off the debt. The Creekside, the legal issue that presents this court is addressed in Rule 13A, CRCP, dealing with mandatory counterclaims. The issue for this court to review in this particular case, which the rule which provides that counterclaims are deemed to be mandatory counterclaims if they arise from the, quote, transaction or occurrence that is the subject matter of the opposing party's claim. What we have before the court today is a difference of opinion and interpretation of the rule concerning what is the transaction or occurrence which was the basis for these two lawsuits. The district court accepted counsel GIAC's position in this matter, that because both of the claims eventually could be traced back to a promissory note and a deed of trust, they arose out of the same transaction, and therefore they should have been asserted in the as a mandatory counterclaim in the 2006 action. It's appellant's position in this case that the transaction or occurrence definition that needs to be applied in this case has to be specific to the facts of the particular case. As one of the courts, in one of the cases that we cited, as I was reading the case preparing, the court indicated, it said, stating the rule about compulsory counterclaims is far easier than determining if a claim passes the logical relationship test. And that's what we have before the court today, because from it is the appellant's position in this case that the transaction or occurrence that is the basis for evaluating the 2007 claims and whether they were in fact compulsory counterclaims must deal with the issues and the law that was and facts that were an issue at in the 2006 suit. And that particular case, yes, it did go eventually, if you follow it all the way back, we would have never had any litigation in this matter, but for the fact that there was a loan made, a deed of trust issued, and there was a default in the payment of that loan when it became matured. But from the standpoint of what was the legal issue and the transaction or occurrence which was at issue in the 2006 suit, that was a legal issue. GIAC in this case was entitled and it said and received summary judgment from the Arapahoe County District Court confirming that the public trustee had no discretion. The public trustee had to issue that deed because the foreclosure had gone through. The efforts at bankruptcy had not stopped it. The foreclosure went through, and having gone through the entire procedure, they were entitled by law to get that deed of trust. And they were also entitled as the court, as a basis for that ruling, would be the determination that Creekside had no further redemption rights. This was under the old statute where they had 75 days after the sale of the property.
Mr. Campbell?
Yes.
Pardon me for interrupting you.
That's
sorry.
Fine.
Isn't it true that in the 2006 case that your client alleged an affirmative defense that basically said, I am not stating this literally and perhaps inelegantly, but that GIAC had done some bad stuff, and because it had done some bad stuff, it wasn't entitled to the property?
The pleadings speak for themselves. I do believe that the court is, Your Honor, is reviewed. In substance, that's what was asserted. It was a defense, and we have also given case law. And I acknowledge they are not. I couldn't find any Colorado cases. And yes, I have found cases that are unpublished in Connecticut. I did my best to try to find law that had factually close. And in those cases, the court makes the distinction between what is a defense in a foreclosure action and what isn't. And your question goes to that very issue, because the issues that were raised ambiguously defense that was asserted in the answer do not go to the execution, performance, or delivery of that note deed of trust. And we've cited cases which make it clear that in the context of foreclosure, that's the only type of defense that you can really assert. So the fact that it was in there would not make it a defense, because Creekside could not, never denied that it executed the deed of trust, executed the note. And there was no proof that they could not bring a check to the court saying, here's the check that we paid off the note when it became due on November 1st. So there was a default.
That takes me to my next question, if I may, please. In the 2007 case, in the pleadings in the 2007 case, if one looks at the last several paragraphs, in paragraph 50 of the complaint, it says that the court has jurisdiction to, under the declaratory judgment statute, to enter a judgment declaring rights and status. And then in 52, it says plaintiff is entitled to an order quieting title to the property and restoring title to the name of Creekside. My question is this. If the 2006 case was basically about who owns the hotel, wasn't the 2007 case about the same thing? Who should own the hotel? And isn't the relief that your client requested, we want the hotel back?
No, Your Honor, and I drafted the pleading, so the inartfulness of it is my error for not inartfully drafting the plea. And we argued at the district court level and in the briefs, what we were asking for was some type of equitable relief, a remedy which would be, in essence, like a constructive trust. There was never any intent, and I don't think the complaint can be construed as an effort to set aside the foreclosure sale. There's nothing in the complaint, as I recall, that says set aside, nullify that. What we were asking was, if there were damages, and if the trier of fact confirmed that they agreed that there was a breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing, and they were damaged, that in equity, and we've cited the cases that the courts say that the court has the right in equity to adopt a remedy that gives relief. And we were in essence asking you, if we're entitled to damages, is there a remedy that gets the title back to us so that they are not allowed to, in essence, reap the benefit of their, what we believe was inequitable and conduct, which was totally violation of the contract, and in essence receive this unjust enrichment. That's the intent of it.
Mr. Campbell?
Yes, sir.
I know we're not here to consider the merits of the claim stated in your complaint, but can you identify for us the specific acts of bad faith and roughly the dates of those?
Yes, Your Honor. The note came due on November 1st. There was an agreement for a six-week extension. Creekside paid $5,000. That $5,000 was later returned, and GIAC reneged on the deal, said that it wasn't going to follow through with it. During that time, Creekside had been trying to get financing. Creekside, in fact, had found financing. And on December 3rd...
Okay, so after November 1st and before December 13th, there was a reneging on, as I'm understanding, an oral agreement.
Yes.
Okay.
And so before the December 15th date, there was a written commitment for loan that was received by GIAC confirming that a loan had been committed by Bank of Pueblo to pay off the loan and deed of trust. On December 13th, that was received. On December 12th, in the pleadings filed by GIAC, GIAC acknowledged that they initiated foreclosure proceedings.
Now, there seems to be a discrepancy between December 12th and December 19th.
Yes, Your Honor, and I guess the point is, in my brief, I took it the 19th because that was in the court of the public trustee's record. I took it from the pleadings, it says initiate, and I think the word initiate could mean that's when they started, although they weren't technically filed. It's critical because the word initiate triggered the $150,000 penalty. So before the 15th, they made that decision. On December 19th, Mr. Kerrigan, on behalf of his client, sends a letter saying, we're going to foreclose, and besides, if you get your loan, you need to pay $150,000 additional dollars. At that point, there was a closing set. They asked for additional time. The closing was set for the 30th. GIAC refused to show. They insisted on the $150,000 payment. There was another issue relating to after that fact. After the bankruptcy came through. Bankruptcy was dismissed.
Well, let's go back to February of 2008. Then, so what I'm understanding is that there was a foreclosure filed in December. There was a foreclosure sale scheduled for February 8th or thereabouts, February 15th, and there was an extension till March 8th, and then on March 8th was when the sale occurred.
Yes. All about what I'm talking about is their efforts to get financing in between. That's the basis for it.
So there's bad faith in that time.
No, it's during this period. They had a closing set for the 30th. The bank, the lender was ready to pay. They refused to participate in it. Then at a later point, when the bankruptcy was over, GIAC was brought a buyer, an investor, came, paid all the money into the public trustee that would have paid off the note, the deed of trust, the principal interest and all the fees and everything. GIAC refused, said, no, we're going to court. We want an order that we own the property. And the third and the last issue comes up in the 2006 case, which required adding all the parties who had an interest. The SBA wasn't joined. They had a third deed of trust. They had a $500,000 deed of trust.
Apart from the SBA, I mean, the issue here is whether you were obligated to file your counterclaim or file a counterclaim at that time. And am I correct that the conduct upon, much of the conduct at least, upon which you are asserting that GIAC engaged in bad faith and unfair dealing, that happened before the 2006 lawsuit was filed?
That's correct, Your Honor, but it happened post-default. And that's where we've given the cases in the brief cited that the post-default actions are not a defense and not a valid counterclaim in a foreclosure action. And that's where we make the distinction. They obviously say you have to bring them in, and the court agreed.
Not a valid counterclaim. Okay, so it's one thing if it's not a valid defense, but
Well, the cases we've cited have, and we have them in there, that the courts have concluded that it's not the same transaction or occurrence. The transaction or occurrence in a foreclosure is the delivery, execution, and performance of the note and deed of trust, and that's it.
Let me follow through on it. Am I correct that you agree that the 2006 action was in the nature of a judicial foreclosure action?
That's the way it's couched by counsel in the...
Well, your brief seems to even...
It's a follow-up. It's a follow-up of the 120. They didn't go back to the 120 because it's very limited in scope, and I think in essence it was in essence a judicial foreclosure, although they didn't ask it because the foreclosure had already gone through.
But if it's in the nature of a judicial foreclosure, at the very least, would you agree that your counterclaim would have been permitted, whereas if it was a Rule 120, it may not have been?
I believe it could have perhaps been permissible if the court allowed. The issue is whether it was mandatory. Yes.
I understand.
And I apologize. I wanted some time to rebuttal, and I guess I'll take whatever's left.
About 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Michael Kerrigan, registration number 24061. I represent General Innkeeping Acceptance Corporation, which I'll refer to also as GAC. Your Honor, in our view, this is a straightforward application of Rule 13, and whether the allegations in the 2007 case constitute the same transaction or occurrence. In this matter, the court is presented with two lawsuits. Both lawsuits involve the same parties, the same contract, the promissory note, the same default, the same property, the same default on that note, and a dispute between the same two parties over who holds the proper title to that.
Do they really address the same note? I mean, what Mr. Campbell is saying, as I understand it, is that he's alleging misconduct unrelated to the note. I mean, I guess not unrelated to the note, but he's saying that you had certain duties and you did not, your GAC breached them and in bad faith.
That, as alleged, and I've looked very carefully at this complaint, because in theory there's an argument that there was an oral agreement to extend the time to cure the default. They have not alleged a breach of that agreement. The contract that they allege is the promissory note, so it is the same note. It's precisely the same note. It's the subject of same of both actions. And so today, in consequence of that, I'm here to discuss two issues.
I'm going to interrupt you again.
Okay.
You're saying that they don't allege a breach of this oral agreement, that they're alleging a breach of the note, and you're reading that in their complaint. And I guess what I'm asking is, on a fair reading of this, do you think your opponent is alleging that under the note you had a duty to extend the closing date past November 1st?
They seem to be. And that's part of the whole problem here, and it goes to some of the other claims.
They seem to be, but is there anything in the agreement in the note that says, if requested, you must extend the closing date?
No, the note had a maturity date of November 1, 2005. It's undisputed they did not pay.
And it seems to me what they're raising here is that after that thereabouts, November 1 thereabouts, there was a discussion, there was $5,000 paid for an extension. So there's an agreement there for an extension. And then somehow or another, the $5,000 was returned and there was no extension. It seems to me they're alleging an oral agreement there.
It seems to be, and their complaint, though, does not allege a breach of that oral agreement. What they allege is somehow we breached the note by not accepting payment 2 months after it was due, and by not indulging them by an extra 2 months, that somehow that is also a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which I would suggest creates puts any creditor into a very difficult circumstance, that essentially when a debtor defaults, comes forward and says, hey, I want a little more time, I need a little more leeway, that somehow it's a breach of the note, and it's a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing to not automatically agree to such an extension.
So where in the complaint do we find this theory of yours? I mean,
Paragraph 20 of the complaint, GIAC breached the terms of the real estate note. That is the first paragraph under the first claim for relief. Again, not a breach of any oral agreement, but it breached the real estate note. And then, referring back to the contract, in paragraph 26, the party's contract included an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Okay.
Counsel, was there any discovery in the 2006 action?
No depositions were taken. There was a motion for summary judgment that we filed early on, and Creekside did not seek to do any discovery, did not seek to add any counterclaims. And what's significant for going to some of the questions we've heard today is their claims for equity came not only in their fifth affirmative defense in the 2006 case. What they also argued extensively in their objection and their response in the summary judgment, and the heart of it can be found in the supplementary record at page 348, they made extensive arguments about equity.
Well, what were those arguments about equity? Did they relate to the same alleged bad faith actions that supposedly took place post-default?
They made no reference to the December 2005 actions, but there were specific ones. An issue raised for the first time in the reply brief is how in July 2006, when they attempted to sell the property that they no longer owed, that's why we brought the 2006 case, is they tried to sell a property they no longer owed. And they claimed that was bad faith for us not to let them engage in that sale of the property they no longer owed. And that same argument reappears for the first time in their reply brief, that somehow that is further evidence of bad faith. So in that respect, the same arguments were made in both cases. In the 2006 case, no, they did not raise the acts in 2005 because they never raised them. They were obligated to do so. Now, there's been discussions today about whether this constituted a judicial foreclosure or not. And counsel acknowledged today that the 2006 case was akin to a judicial foreclosure. In that concept, there are two things that are important. First of all, I refer you all to a very important case cited, in fact, by Creekside in their opening brief on page 12, and that's the Torbett versus Griffith case. And that appears at 550 P second 350. Remarkably similar facts where a debtor owned a motel, didn't make payments, they were foreclosed upon. They did not respond to that foreclosure action. It was a judicial foreclosure. They didn't respond at all. And after they lost the property in foreclosure, they brought fraud claims back against the lender. And in that case, the district court said, wait a minute, if you had fraud claims relating to the transactions relating to your ownership in the foreclosure, you were obligated to bring them. And the district court in that case granted, just like the district court did in our action, granted a Rule 12 motion to dismiss. And the Court of Appeals, in reliance on Rule 13A, said those are compulsory counterclaims you should have raised. And in light of this overwhelming evidence and the overwhelming Colorado case law, that's why Creekside has had to go all the way to the state of Connecticut. And in so doing, trying to blur the lines between what is the Rule 120 proceeding, where we acknowledge that's when, in those proceedings, you can only talk about the making of the note and whether it was satisfied. We agree they could not have brought counterclaims in that action. But the distinction is we brought a separate action under Rule 57 that has broad application, allows court to declare the relationships and interactions between the parties and their rights and relationships with respect to specific contracts. Here, we filed that separate action that did have the effect of a judicial foreclosure. Now, the Connecticut cases relied on in the reply brief and cited extensively, those occur because, as much as I have researched it, and near as I can tell, it's because Connecticut doesn't have a Rule 120 proceeding. They have a separate foreclosure law. They don't use public trustees, and that's why those cases have a different set of rules as to what can be brought and what is a compulsory counterclaim. Totally inapplicable here under Colorado law where things are different. Now, the fact is that this the state of Colorado, going back as far as 40 years ago, in the visual factor versus Sinclair case, adopted the logical relationship test. And there can be little doubt that the relief sought by GEAC in the 2006 case had a logical relationship to the claims brought in the 2007 lawsuit. Specifically, what we asked for was a ruling from the court as to the respective rights of the parties. We also asked for a ruling unequivocally that GEAC owned the property, and unequivocally that Creekside had no rights left in the property. There is no way for them to recover the relief they've sought in the 2007 lawsuit without totally invalidating the 2006 lawsuit, a lawsuit that they tried to appeal and ultimately never perfected their appeal, and thus it became a final judgment. Now,
pardon me for a minute, if I may, Mr. Carrier. I want to understand how far your argument goes. Let us use a hypothetical that is not this case. Assume that instead of the fifth claim for relief in the 2007 lawsuit, the end of the 2007 lawsuit said, we don't want the property back. We don't want the hotel. All we want is damages because we believe that GEAC acted inappropriately and we can prove it. We just want money, no hotel. Would your argument be the same?
It would, Your Honor, because of the fact that those damages arise out of the supposed bad conduct during the foreclosure, that again, it still relates to the same default, still relates to the same note, the same basic contract, and therefore that is still offshoots of the same basic controversy, and therefore covered by the McKay versus United Bank case. Even though those claims might involve different evidence, in Greinberg versus Rocky Mountain Natural Gas, this court said Rule 12 dismissal is appropriate for related claims, even if they would involve the separate evidence. And part of that reason, Your Honor, is because we would be raising the same defenses into their request for equitable relief, because their breach of contract claim doesn't necessarily involve a request for equitable relief, but certainly their unjust enrichment does. Their tortious interference, all those claims involve a broad sweeping claim for equitable relief. Well, they made those same claims to the same court in 2006, and that court rejected them in toto. That court, as part of their finding, recognized, and I'm quoting the trial court in its February 2nd, 2007 order, that Creekside's own fraud, deceit, and misrepresentations prohibited the relief sought. And the court continued, Creekside is not an innocent victim. So essentially, they want two bites at the apple, and they want to be able to come back. And to add your hypothetical, what if there was another lender that fell through, and they were able to proceed in their 2006 case, and they lost it? And setting aside a statute of limitations argument, then could they bring a third lawsuit and say, hey, oh, by the way, there's another lender that was ready to back up Pueblo State Trust, but that fell through too because GEAC was unfair to us. How many lawsuits are they able to bring?
Is that a compulsory counterclaim argument or is it a res judicata argument?
I think it's both. And there is some overlapping aspects of those. I suppose it would turn on why the court ruled in our favor in the 2007 lawsuit. If it held that our actions and our decision to proceed with the foreclosure was proper, then it would also be a res judicata. I would also submit to your honors that there is an additional basis beyond the Rule 13 arguments that we submitted in our answer brief and to the trial court, and that is the separate doctrine under Colorado law that parties having failed to exercise their redemption rights cannot then later claim lost profits and lost equity. While Colorado had the redemption regime, there are numerous cases going back to 1925 that say your remedy, if there is excess profits and excess equity in the property, which is the heart of their damages, then your remedy is simply to redeem. If you haven't done that, you can't bring yet another action to claim you've lost those profits, you've lost those damages. Those cases and that authority that we present to the court is a separate and independent basis to affirm the trial court's dismissal. Your Honors, in this case, the fact is both sides have traded accusations about bad faith and supposed inequitable conduct. And there is, the fact is, many of these same arguments were, in fact, made by Creekside in the 2006 case. And the difference between the arguments traded by the parties and the accusations is one of the parties, my client, actually can point not just to accusations, but extensive cases and decisions that are in the record from federal courts, from bankruptcy courts, and from other, from a variety of district courts that have recognized Creekside's bad conduct. In light of that well-recognized and established record, it would indeed be ironic and unjust if once again Creekside was allowed to manipulate the court system for because of its own actions and inactions. It had an opportunity, it had its day in court, and it failed to exercise its rights. Accordingly, it should be held to the same standards of any other litigant. It should be held to the same standards as the party in the Torbert versus Griffith case, and having lost and failed to exercise their rights, they should be foreclosed from litigating this yet again. The courts are full enough and busy enough without litigants being able to raise the same arguments over and over again. We ask you to affirm the district court's dismissal of Creekside's 2006 complaint. Seven complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Mr. Campbell, you've got about a half a minute if you want to do some rebuttal.
Well, the limited time, and I guess the case that I would cite the court to is Bethune versus Kane, with this Court of Appeals 3 years at 4 years, 3 years after the visual factor case by the Colorado Supreme Court said that a logical relationship, and it's the reason, the purpose for the rule was designed that the counterclaim is logically related to the opposing party's claim, where separate trials on each of these respective claims would involve a substantial duplication of effort and time in the parties in the court. And that's why we have tried to address in our brief. And I guess that's
Mr. Campbell, I have a question. So you're saying that GIAC had a duty of good faith and fair dealing, and where does that arise from? What's the source of that duty?
It would be the duty of good faith implied in all contracts, and we cited the cases that includes exercising remedies that are available for post-default or
So which contract are you talking about then? Which contract do you say it arises from?
Well, it would have to be the original loan, the original note, which was extended. And even after default, it's our position that they have an obligation to exercise those rights in a manner which would not be intended to thwart the reasonable contract expectations of the borrower, which in this case would be if I arrange to have the interest, the principal, the cost, and attorney's fees that you're owed, and I have it and I'm ready to pay, then I have the right to believe that you expect that you will take that payment, that you will not do something to avoid that so that you end up going through the foreclosure, becoming in the title when I had made arrangements. And you, for your reason and based upon your discretion, decided to choose to foreclose at a $150,000 payment, which throws off the financing. And
so let me ask you, so do I understand correctly that your allegations in the 2007 suit are that in the promissory note, GIAC undertook a duty of good faith and fair dealing, and that their various actions violated that duty in breach of the promissory note?
That is the contract. It is the, and it's all post-default, so that's why it was involved in the 2006 case, and that's where we have our difference of opinion about whether that's a transaction. We have cited cases which do not deal with Connecticut. They deal with other issues where you go back to the same. You can go back eventually and find where they all connect, and the courts have said it's not a duplication of the evidence, and we tried to deal with that in our briefs, and I appreciate the extra minute.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. And the case will stand.